Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
It's actually about movies and wine.
You just have to correct me every time.
I'm gonna make Jamie put out a Twitter poll when this episode drops on, by the way, it's dropping on September 10th, not on September 11th, Jamie. You cannot read a calendar.
I can't read a calendar.
You cannot read a calendar. Anyone hoping for Jamie and I providing you some kind of solace on the September 11th, 20th anniversary, which is what Jamie suggested. I'm sorry. We will not be able to comfort you with our fucking bullshit on 9/11. You guys are on your own and we can't be there to help you.
I mean, the episode will be out. You can enjoy yourself.
I guess that's true. All right, fine. Everybody should save it. Save it for tomorrow. You're going to need us and the moral support and sense of community that we can provide.
And our dulcet tones.
Right.
And our bits.
Oh, but sorry. The whole reason I brought that up is to say that the day that the episode drops, I think Jamie should put out a Twitter poll.
Is this podcast about movies and wine or about wine and movies?
That's right.
No, I disagree. We're just going to fight about this forever.
That's fine. The internet won't help us resolve anything. It never does. That's not what it's for.
Anyway, for everyone out there who doesn't know anything about one or both of these topics, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help. Each episode, we're going to recommend a movie that I love and a wine that he loves.
And we fill in the gaps you might not already know. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't.
This is part three of our ongoing mini-series titled, unofficially, Jimbo Jambo's Viticultural History of These Here United States. Jamie is picking significant American wines, and I am pairing American movies to go alongside them.
Today, we're starting with Dash Cellars Vineyard Select Zinfandel. For those of you looking for a bottle, it is available at Astor Wine and Spirits for $22 plus shipping. I recommend you buy a bunch of it because it is super fucking yummy. Dash Cellars was opened by Michael and Ann Dash in Oakland, California in 1996. They've since moved to a new facility at the Old Naval Air Base in Alameda, which for those of you not familiar with California geography is very close to Oakland. It's sort of in the same metro area. They focus significantly on single vineyard Zinfandel from Sonoma County and also specifically Dry Creek, which is an area that's famous for Zinfandel in particular. Notably, they source fruit from some of the oldest vineyards in California, including Bedrock Vineyard, planted in 1888, Evangelo, planted in 1890, as well as a host of others, including Lovao and Lily Hill. The vineyards that they source from aren't exclusively old, though it's a trend. The Vineyard Select is their entry-level Zin. It's blended from fruit that doesn't make it into single vineyard cuvées. We probably have already talked about this a little bit. When I say entry-level and blended from things that don't make it to single vineyard, doesn't mean it's lower quality. It means it is better to drink younger.
That's what entry-level means.
Yes.
Not meant for aging.
Correct. I think this wine is everything that I love about wine in a glass. It's satisfying, it's full, it's also zippy and light on its feet. It's got so much fruit character to it. It's got all of the raspberries and the blueberries and the blackberries and the currants and the mulberries and the just everything with like a little bit of like earth and oak to balance it all together.
Anyway, Jamie, what pairing words did you use to set me up for this?
Actually, phrases that I gave you.
That's true. There's a lot of words.
Refined technique, time machine, mouth filling, parentheses, a mouthful, end parentheses, and urban.
So refined technique, time machine, mouth filling, parentheses, a mouthful, and urban. So based on that, all of that, I paired Minding the Gap. This is a 2018 documentary from first-time feature filmmaker Bing Liu. It won a special jury award at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. It won a Peabody. And it was nominated for Best Documentary at the 2019 Oscars. It was distributed by Magnolia and Hulu is its current home where you can stream it right about now. In the doc, director Bing Liu follows two skater boys, Zach and Kier, from Bing's own hometown of Rockford, Illinois. The doc starts as like this really polished kind of slice of life skateboarding video, and then it quickly reveals what it's actually about, which is Bing delving into the child abuse that he and Zach and Kier all suffered at the hands of their parents or step-parents, and how the three of them have carried that trauma into their early adulthood.
I would like to take this moment just to explain for everyone that that stutter that Scott did on the word skater is him doffing his cap to there being an eight in place of...
Skater Bowie.
That's right.
Come on, Jamie.
I want to be very, very clear for anyone out there who's listening who isn't a member of our generation.
Right, which is no one. The only people who could possibly tolerate listening to this show are geriatric millennials.
Yeah.
anybody older and anybody younger would roll their eyes and say, this is some millennial bullshit, and then just switch off.
Some people like millennial bullshit.
I think it's millennials.
It's mostly millennials.
We love smelling our own shit.
I wish that I didn't identify so firmly with that remark.
Yeah. But yeah, Skater Boys.
Skater Boys.
Yeah, everyone's familiar with the seminal works of Avril Lavigne. But so yeah, that's the movie. It is good. So Jamie, before we dig into all of your extensive and fucking masturbatory vocabulary describing the intellectual experience or not of this wine, why did you pick it? Tell me what you like about it.
Anyone out there who knows me or has seen my social media presence or any of that knows that I'm like the Zinfandel cheerleader of the wine world. And I am honestly baffled that I'm really the only one that I know.
You're the Zinfandel cheerleader of the wine world.
I mean, as a somm, there certainly are winemakers and wineries that are like, that focus on this thing. But as like a specifically restaurant person, whenever someone asks me what my favorite grape is and I say Zinfandel, everyone is flabbergasted by that.
I hope Riesling was your favorite.
No.
Then why have we done 9 Rieslings on this show?
Because I do love Riesling.
I thought Rosé was your favorite.
Rosé isn't a grape, Scott.
Right, because Rosé is stupid. Rosé is dumb.
Rosé is dumb. We're going to fight right now.
We'll save it for the next time we talk about a rosé, which should be like tomorrow.
Rosé is dumb, he says.
I just think it's...
Having loved the love drunk rosé we just did.
And all the other rosés we've done on the show. Yeah. I just think it's dumb that it's a thing, but it's made many different ways. It just means pink. Rosé is just describing the color.
Yes.
And really nothing else about the wine.
That's correct.
Okay, great. That's what I think is dumb about it.
So you take exception with the category not describing it.
Correct.
So you have a problem with wine, period.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do.
I mean, so do I.
Right.
It's a problem. Anyway, fucking Zinfandel is great. I think it's awesome. I think that it can do so many different things. The two probably most popular ways to make Zinfandel have been, in the last century, white Zinfandel a la Sutterholm and really high octane, amped up, extracted Zinfandel a la Ravenswood.
This is amped up, high octane Zinfandel, right?
It leans more in that direction for sure. But the really amped up high octane stuff is like, will have much more tannin than this, will be even fuller body, might even have some residual sugar to it.
I could go for some residual sugar.
There is some sugar, but it's masked by acidity and like it's very well integrated. It's a thoughtfully made wine.
It's very tasty.
So I picked it A, because I just love Zinfandel, but also because in this mini series of, hold on, let me just get the right verbiage, Jimbo Jambo's Viticultural History of These Here United States.
That's right.
Like I could do a whole mini series on 6 different Zinfandels.
Right.
It's important to the US. It was planted very widely in California prior to Prohibition, and the oldest vine material in the United States is either Zinfandel or what's called mixed black vineyards, which tend to be Zinfandel-based, interplanted with things like Alicante Boucher and Dolcetto and Barbera and Syrah and Mourvèdre and like a ton of other things. So aside from the character of the wine itself, which I find to be just straight up delicious, it's also important in the narrative of American wine.
All right.
What do you think?
Of this wine? I mean, I think it's pretty important in the narrative of American wine. I think maybe you're overstating it a little bit just to like, you know, back up your point. No, I really like this wine. You would actually be proud of this. I had quite a tasting experience with this the other night.
Yeah.
Before I watched the movie again. So I had 3 glasses of it in front of me.
3 separate glasses.
3 separate glasses. Glass number 1, the first pour from a freshly opened bottle. All right.
Cool.
Glass number 2. The second pour from said bottle, moments later, hyper-decanted.
Cool.
I don't know if it's actually technically hyper-decanting, but I just pour it in a decanter and then just like shake the fuck out of it. And I just go hyper-decanted. And to me, the theme song makes it hyper-decanting. So I had a glass like that. And then the last glass was from a bottle that we opened a week ago. 3 radically different experiences of this wine. Can I just throw down my notes at you? Because you're gonna be...
Throw it down.
I got some notes here. From glass number 1. First pour, new bottle. It's big, bold. On the nose, I was getting bacon, figs, and steak sauce.
Steak sauce, like A1 steak sauce?
Like Heinz steak sauce.
Ooh.
The tang that's the same in both, specifically the tang.
Right.
But I was getting something more tomato-y than the dark Worcester.
What's this here sauce is what it's called. That's how you pronounce it.
What's this here sauce?
Okay. Yes. And just so that we're very clear to everyone in the whole world, A1 is the best steak sauce.
It is good. That just wasn't the note I was getting.
Right.
Right. But so for that first glass, notes of red meat and tang and dark fruit and spice. I got tart strawberries, mega tannins. It needed to breathe. I could tell that. On the nose, I was getting saline.
Saline.
Specifically like seawater or like bay water. So not like, you know, clinical saline.
Right.
But a salty water. And the bacon taste, I was getting like blackened crispy bacon, like super charred carbon bacon.
Nice crispy bacon.
That's right. For my next glass, which was hyper decanted, I was getting cherries and vanilla on the nose, which was not appearing in the other glass. The taste of that one was really jammy. Strawberry fruit leather. My wife used to make dehydrated like fruit leather. I was getting not strawberries, but strawberry fruit leather and steak. So our savory meat flavor was changing from bacon into something more like steak.
Right. And the hyper decanted bottle was much less savory than the first one.
Yes.
More fruit driven.
Much more fruit, especially on the nose. And then my last glass, which was the one that we'd opened like a week before, the nose was jammy. It was like caramelized fruit sugar. And then, so this was weird. So let me describe to you this intellectual process and see if this makes sense to you.
Okay.
When I am tasting and trying to take notes seriously, once I identify a flavor, I am then able to identify more flavors that previously unidentified flavor was masking. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, so that makes perfect sense.
So for that last glass, I couldn't place what the note was. And then finally, when I was getting on the nose, when I realized that the smell was reminding me of caramelized sugar, like caramelized fruit sugar, immediately I was able to identify fresh blueberries and whipped cream after that. And in my notes, I describe it as like it's underneath that smell. So like once I can categorize the first smell, I can kind of set it aside, and then suddenly other things are available now that I can say, oh, this is the fruit sugar thing, and now I know what all these other things are.
I'm very proud of you.
I think I am as well.
A little choked up. You're doing great. I love all of those notes.
Yeah.
And I think this wine sort of illustrates the point that I was making before that Zinfandel can do so many things.
Yeah.
But so this here movie, Minding the Gap, what are your thoughts? Why did you choose it? What's the deal here?
I love it and it's great. And I chose it for those reasons. I saw this movie, I guess, for the first time January or earlier this year, and it just knocked me on the ground and I was devastated by it. This is a recurrent theme in the show that has been brought to my attention. I should take a brief side note to address it here. My wife has recently said that I need to start picking movies that I cannot in any way describe as devastating.
Yeah, I was going to call you out in this episode for that. You're stealing my thunder a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's her thunder.
It would be nice if I watched a movie for this podcast that didn't make me want to curl into a ball and cry.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, the things that resonate with me, I guess, are frequently devastating. But I also, and this is not a thing for most people, but I like difficult movies. I like things that are challenging, things that are emotional. I don't know. Movies are a safe way to experience a broad spectrum of emotion and experiences, and something that is devastating and that makes me fucking cry, like in a safe way that when it's over, I can turn it off and compartmentalize it and put it away. Like that, I find a lot of value in that.
When you describe it that way, it makes total sense. But then when I'm sitting down and watching these movies,
right,
I can't.
I just think it's a masterfully made documentary and it resonates with me in a lot of ways, even though I'm not a skater boy and never have been. And like, I didn't come from a household of, you know, not the kind of child abuse that these guys experienced. Like I got spanked when I was a kid. That was about it. But it just resonates with me in such a huge way. And I feel like I know all three of those guys after a 90-minute feature about them. And yeah, I just love it. And I want more people to see it. So obviously you struggled with it. It's difficult, but like, did you like it? What do you think of the movie?
It's great. It's like a shining example of how to express a specific human experience, but also the broad human experience. Like, it's obviously we're not people who grew up in suburban Illinois or in economically depressed areas. There's not a lot of direct one-to-one empathy that we can have with these guys. But you feel their emotions, and it takes you to places that you've been, or it took me to places that I've been, you know, that are very much not the places that these guys are, but like, it's delving into open wounds that kind of we all have. Like you said, I think it's masterfully made. You can see the skill at work. You can see the intent.
I mean, that's a huge part of it, right? Like the intent comes through so strong, especially with the, you can say subject. Director Bing refers to his two subjects as characters and refers to himself as a character in the movie, just as like a very, I think, a healthy distance way to talk about how he shapes the stories in the movie, like in the editorial process. But through the character or the subject of Zach, like, there is no judgment of that guy.
None at all.
Spoilers, if you have not watched this documentary, please just go and watch it. Like, turn our stupid voices off and go watch the movie. It's great. We'll see you in an hour and a half. But Zach, by the end of the movie, like, we find out that he, who as a kid was abused, he is now abusing his partner and the live-in mother of his child. I don't ever feel like Zach is judged. The movie never, like, turns on him, you know? And that's the intent that you're talking about. Like, it's empathetic towards everybody.
Yeah. So I love it. I think it's great. I'm really glad that I had a big full-bodied wine with me to sort of keep me company.
Oh, yeah.
And also, just to echo the point that we've already made, I was a little upset with you while I was watching this movie because you complained so much about the difficult and more intellectual wines that I've presented to you. Mm-hmm. And here you are fucking me up emotionally with this fucking documentary that is hard.
I mean, I guess that's a pretty slanted way of describing this dichotomy. I have not complained about certain wines that you've presented because they're difficult or challenging, but because they taste bad.
I'm going to slap you in public. I'm going to take you out into the street and slap you there.
So, James, the first phrase that you gave me for this pairing was refined technique. Talk to me about the refined technique that the folks at, it's Dash Cellars, Dash. Not Dashy.
Yeah, Dash.
That the folks at Dash Cellars are dropping in this bottle here.
This is a team that came into the founding of this winery with a high level of expertise. It wasn't an upstart that, like, young people doing, you know, cool, fun things.
Right.
It was.
These are not disruptors.
No, they are seasoned professionals who are like, okay, now it's time for us to do our own thing. They've got a really impressive resume. So we'll start with Michael Dash, who started at UC Santa Cruz. Got his degree in biology and environmental science, then got a master's in enology from UC Davis, which I've mentioned before, is like the winemaking school.
And enology is the study
of winemaking.
Of grapery.
Of winemaking specifically. Enology is making wine, and then viticulture is
growing
grapes. Yeah.
Right. Growing grapes. I've taken to heart your bitching from last time about how the problem with terroir is that terroir only talks about as though the place is doing all the work and not the people. And I'm on board with you. Fucking the artist and the creator needs to be represented.
Damn right.
We don't grow wine. We grow grapes. I'm growing grapes. I don't say that I'm growing wine behind my garage. I'm growing grapes.
I love that photo you sent me of the grape cluster. That was good.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah. I'm glad you loved it. You didn't text me back or anything.
I mean, I was in the middle of doing something.
You didn't
else.
Hit me up. That's fine. You were able to look at it.
It was a pretty picture.
You just do a little long press and just do like a thumbs up or a heart or something.
I could have, but I didn't.
That's all I'm saying.
It was nice. It was a nice photo. I like it.
Nice photo. I send Jamie a lot of texts.
I'm probably going to use it for the social media.
You have to get permission from the photographer first.
Do I have permission?
Not yet.
Fuck you.
We'll have to negotiate.
Piece of shit. So before starting the winery, after his degrees, he had a short stint writing video game manuals for Atari, which is kind of fun.
When was this? What era of Atari is this?
This is the like late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, wow. So like they're just getting into like the home console market. Yep. This is
the very fucking
this
beginning.
Is the peak of Atari, though.
Yeah. Then he went on to work at Rowden Smith Winery in California, which is sort of an under the radar great producer. Then very over the radar, Schramsberg, greatest producer of domestic sparkling wine. In my not very humble opinion, then Cloudy Bay of New Zealand, then Chateau Lafite Rothschild in Bordeaux, and then finally, he was the assistant winemaker at Ridge under Paul Draper. Ridge, notably, is whenever you say Zinfandel and California in the same breath, Ridge comes up. Ridge is like they perfected essentially the art of Zinfandel.
Like globally or just the American version of Zinfandel?
The most prestigious wines made from this grape are without doubt the American versions, and particularly Ridge. Paul Draper is another one of those like sort of tectonic figures in wine, and specifically in American wine. And so it's notable that Michael Dash worked under him. Anne, his wife, grew up in Brittany in France and went to the University of Bordeaux for enology. Funny little aside, she was split between wanting to do enology and wanting to do perfume science. And a professor at the school said, you'll never get into the enology program because you're a woman. And so she got into the enology program.
Yeah.
Which I just love.
Fuck you, professor.
Exactly.
Also, enology and the study of perfume, they're basically the same. I'm told they're the same scents. Therefore, what you're sniffing is the same as what you're tasting, even though we categorize those notes differently.
In a very broad way, sure. I'm not going to argue with you right now.
Jamie, let's decant some cologne. And we'll have a drink later of, I don't know, whatever fucking cologne you wear.
I don't wear cologne.
No?
No.
So that's just a natural odor that you carry about with you.
That's just my musk.
Okay, got it. Cork taint and ball sweat is Jamie's musk. No one will be bottling that.
Cork taint and ball sweat. That's the name of a chapter in my autobiography.
It could be a new podcast title.
It could be. So anyway, Anne worked at Chateau La Dominique in Saint-Emilion in Bordeaux before leaving France. Then she worked at Chapelet.
I've been to Chapelet.
Such a great place.
That's a gorgeous vineyard.
Oh my God. And it's up on Pritchard Hill and you can see the whole valley and their wines are just astoundingly good.
Yeah.
So then after that, for a couple of years, she was a research enologist at RMS Brandy Distillery. So sort of honing in on the aroma and flavor specifics. And then she married Michael Dash and opened Dash Cellars. They also work with a winemaker who does the day-to-day winemaking with Michael overseeing. This guy also holds a degree from UC Davis and has spent some years in both the Franciscan and Stag's Leap wineries, both of which, if you don't know, are very important wineries of the Napa Valley.
All right, so James, this is all about, you're giving me the CV for these people. They've got good bona fides, but what is the technique, the refined technique that they are bringing to the table here?
I was getting there.
I know, I'm just trying to keep the conversation alive.
This all contributes to precision in the cellar. They buy grapes from farmers. These farmers don't necessarily have their own wineries. They are trusting that the grape growers are doing their jobs in a rigorous and good way. And then in turn, in the cellar, you're talking about cellar hygiene and specific pick dates based on lab analysis and trying to set everything up so that they don't have to intervene in ways such as adding sugar or acidity or much sulfur at all. They do all native yeast fermentation. They're aiming to intervene as little as possible is the idea. So intervene
in what? In the fermentation?
In the fermentation process. And there are a number of ways that you can do that, which include adding acid, adding sugar, adding sulfur, and then adding like yeast nutrients to sort of shepherd the fermentation along. None of these constitute a sin.
Okay.
What I'm getting at here is doing a lot of work beforehand, making sure that the cellar is immaculately clean, making sure that all of your vessels are in the right place for your transfers to be made, making sure that you're out in the vineyard doing analysis on the grapes so that your pick date is has exactly the chemistry that you want for your ferment, means that you have to adjust fewer times once the grapes get to you, which means you are affecting the wine less, which gets you a more... And now I'm like,
this is about terroir, right?
This is about expressing the place. Yeah. This is about taking the grapes and making sure that the human imprint is as small as possible.
But so this is philosophically against your anti-terroir beef.
It's not though, but because think about how much work has to get done in order to do that. Added acid has a particular taste to it. When I taste a wine that has been obviously acidified, there is like the pinprick kind of sensation that you get on the tip of your tongue when you eat a sweet tart. And that tells me that the wine has been acidified and the whole thing feels less like a rounded hole and more like pieces put together. And then added sugar is a similar deal. Fermented white sugar that you add to a ferment to raise your alcohol because you picked too early has a particular taste to it. It is perceptible when these interventions happen.
But they're not sins, you said.
I don't think so. I think that if you have to make an adjustment, you should, because otherwise you end up with a fucked up wine that just doesn't taste good. Is it a sin to have had some kind of oversight on set where you have to fix in post?
For some people it is. Yeah.
Right, but for some people, like in a very real sense, when you're working on a time frame and with a budget and yeah. like in the physical world that we occupy, it has to happen. And so you put out the best product you can.
Right. But for some people, it's a sin. For some people, ADR is a sin. Like if you can't get the live sound on the day, like you keep doing it until you can, or you control for all factors so you can get the real sound.
Which is nice if you have that luxury, if right. you have that extra money, that extra time, that extra whatever.
Right. Well, so this sounds like it's more, it's just a personal stamp. It's a stylistic and creative philosophical thing, right?
Correct.
Like,
yes, okay. Yes, yes.
You were saying that so that they can precisely lock down what the harvest date is, they do a lot of tests on the vines and the grapes.
On the grapes.
What are they doing and how does that tell them when to harvest and what does that date translate to in terms of me drinking it?
So primarily they're testing for Brix and acidity. Brix, B-R-I-X, is a measure in degrees of how much sugar is in solution.
Okay,
and
great.
That translates directly to potential alcohol.
Because the more sugar you have, the more sugar can ferment and produce alcohol.
Correct.
Great.
And then acid is, usually they're testing for tartaric acid is in solution, which will give you sort of an idea of how tart, sour, whatever your wine is. Now, here's the thing. With grape maturity, you start with like extreme high acid. And as the grape matures, acids start to fall and sugars begin to rise. And the trick is catching the grapes at the point where those two, in a finished wine, the alcohol and the acid will be in balance. And then there's a third bit, which is the what they call phenolic maturity, with flavor maturity of the grape, which means you have all of the characteristics of that grape have come to fruition, essentially. And that is less of a scientific thing and more of a like you walk through a vineyard and you taste it.
You just pop a grape off and you eat one.
That's right. Beginning in mid-August, you're out in the vineyard as often as possible, grabbing bunches of grapes, then bringing them back to the lab and testing them over and over again, and then sort of looking at that and then also looking at weather reports, because if it rains the day prior to your harvest, your grapes are going to swell with a ton of water, which is going to have a negative impact on the final wine.
So if it rains, do you then postpone harvesting? So
you
that
either
they can
postpone or you go quicker to try and beat the rain. It's this balancing act between like, okay, maybe we have almost the phenolic ripeness that we want, but if we hold off past the rain, we're going to have dramatically high sugar and low acid. So we're going to compromise on the maturity so that we can harvest at the right chemistry.
This all sounds extremely difficult.
It is.
It sounds like it's not easy to make wine.
That is correct.
The more I'm learning about it, the more it seems like I don't want to do this for a living. I'm on the right career trajectory to not end up being a winemaker or a grape grower, but I'm glad for that because it sounds very difficult.
It's hard, but it's also rewarding and fun. And like, especially as harvest happens once a year, and for that, you know, 2 month to 3 month span, you're working 7 days a week, 100 hours or whatever. And it follows this yearly cycle as opposed to the weekly cycle that the rest of us kind of are on. And there's a part of that that is appealing. You know, when I've worked harvest, it's kind of cool to be like balls to the walls, working until you die for just a little while, and then like big relax right after. So I said refined technique. Obviously, I didn't say all of those words to you that right. I just said refined technique. Where did your head go and what led you here?
So for one, it's a little bit of a contrapuntal pairing for me because this is not refined technique. This is this guy's first feature film. He is a young, fresh talent. He is, I think, 31 as of right now.
Wow.
But it's his first feature as a director. He's worked in camera departments since he was 19. So 2014, he starts the project knowing nothing about documentary. He ends up getting Cardam Keene on board as a producer. Cardam Keene is a nonprofit documentary collective that has a political and issue-driven focus, and they help mentor and shepherd documentary filmmakers and like give them access to screening rooms and resources and like peers. He gets Steve James on as a mentor and an executive producer. Steve James is like an extremely important American documentarian. He's probably best known for directing the documentary Hoop Dreams. And then finally, like Bing is able to start getting grant funding for the project. And it really starts to move by like 2017 when PBS comes on board and their POV documentary program like kind of underwrites the movie. But he was working on it for 3 years before he even had funding. And then like a year later, January, he's at Sundance with this project. So like it was a very quick escalation in terms of him going from being a guy who shot skate videos all throughout his teenage years and didn't know anything about documentary. And then all of a sudden he premieres his first documentary feature at Sundance and then it gets fucking Oscar nominated.
So his technique is not refined.
Like his technique as a documentarian is raw and he's learning on the job. That for me is the other thing about refined technique is that the task of making a documentary is inherently about refinement. The technique that you are deploying is about refining material.
What do you mean by that?
The way a documentary works, and Bing has described it in this way, and many, many other documentarians have described it this way, is that in a documentary, you only find out what story you're telling in the edit. Like you set out with a subject. I'm going to make a documentary about young, you know, skaters in Rockford, Illinois. And I will try to explore the themes of childhood abuse and trauma. But he doesn't know when he starts making the movie necessarily who his subjects are going to be, how long it's going to be, what narrative threads he ends up following. So the whole technique is about refinement. It was only 3 months before the world premiere of the movie at Sundance that Bing decided to include his old archival skate footage from when he was a kid. That was a super late in the game decision. And it was just a matter of like him working on it and doing edits. He worked with another editor on the project and he did lots of screenings for other mentors and professional documentarians. He got lots of feedback from them. And through that, the process evolved. So that's the second way that I mean it's refined technique. The technique itself of putting together a doc is about taking all your raw material and then figuring out what it is.
It is the technique of refining.
Yes, I said that. So yeah, there's all these things that came about through the process of refining the movie and having it evolve. Bing himself wasn't initially going to be on screen in the movie.
We talked about this a little bit off mic. It is an interesting transition in the film.
He philosophically wanted the filmmaker behind the camera to be a character. He very quickly, through all of his mentors, like learned which documentaries to watch, and he learned like the different styles, and one of which is in Verite documentary, the Verite is just like super realistic documentary. Like there's no voiceover. We never have cutaways to talking heads. It's just in the world and it's real. But then another school of thought says, bring the filmmaker and the behind the camera presence into it more and let the filmmaker interact with the characters and let the characters interact with him, which you see like Bing navigates in the movie. There's a couple of times, there's a great part where Zach just looks at the camera. And he's like, so what kind of filming are we doing now? Are we doing filming where I talk to you? Or are we doing filming where I pretend that you're not there? He's like talking about his own process and his thought process on the movie, how it's evolving. And he's navigating that as we're watching it. For Bing, he said that once Nina revealed to him that Zach had been abusing her, yeah. Nina is one of our subjects, Zach. Nina is his partner, girlfriend, mother of his child. Once she revealed that Zach had been abusing her, Bing knew that he had to put himself into it. Like he had been keeping his own child abuse out of the story and hadn't revealed it to the other two characters or the other two subjects. But at that point, he had skin in the game, especially once you get to that scene in the car where he's in the back of the car and the two of them go to pick up like takeout or something. And then he just straight up asks her. He said in interviews that he was running out of time. Like that was one of the last times he knew he was going to have to sit with her.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, what do you think I'd do about this? Because you told me that he abused you and he showed me this video of a fight that you guys had after he had been beating you. What do you think I'm supposed to do next? And she basically told him, like, I can't have you bring that up. You can't talk with him about that.
Right.
And the way he described it is that his character, the character of Bing, the filmmaker, suddenly had an objective. And now he discovered what his story was going to be and that he had to be involved. What he said was, putting myself in Minding the Gap was my attempt to get over the paradox of a filmmaker being vulnerable in a movie where they have control. I needed to find a way to relieve myself of that control. He worked with an editor, Josh Altman, who helped him shape key scenes in the movie, like the climactic montage or the big interview with his mom.
God, that
the interview with his mom is crazy. Right. But it was just all this evolving process. Like, his mom was never going to be in the movie. He was never going to talk about himself or his own experiences. And then it just happened. And he realized that, like, responsibly, he had to involve himself and it would make the movie better.
And it's interesting how that plays out in the runtime of the actual film. The audience starts not knowing this. And it's very clear that there's a delineation from when Bing is like the observer to him putting himself in. It tells that story of his decision-making almost.
Yeah.
Or it at least hints to that story. The first part of the movie doesn't have him as an on-screen presence really at all, except in a couple of skate videos. And then suddenly, there's this ramp up where you hear his voice a little bit more, and he's talking to Nina, and then he's talking to Zach, and then he's on camera with his mother. And, well, that was a whole scene.
Yeah. If you haven't watched the movie, the scene we're talking about is where Bing sits down with his mother and basically, like, on camera and on mic, he confronts her. He says, like, do you know what was happening in the house when you were out at work and I was at home with your new husband, with my stepfather? I was abused the first time I was ever alone with him, and it happened all the time. Like, were you aware? It's so deftly handled. That's another case in the movie where I feel like there's no judgment. I don't feel like we judge his mom.
No, absolutely not.
And if he judges his mom, it's not coming through at all either.
I think we have some major sympathy for her. I mean, we know it has been established that this is a very kind of dire area. It's very economically depressed. Nobody's having a good time. Everyone is hurting all the time.
Yeah. And she's an immigrant. He was born in China. The two of them came to this country. She worked three jobs while he was a kid. And they describe this story where the guy who becomes Bing's stepfather just kind of like follows them home one day and comes into the house. And they sort of yada, yada, yada through how suddenly somehow he's the stepfather.
Yeah. Part of me wonders about the yada, yada. And then
right.
Another part of me absolutely doesn't want to know. But you're right. We don't judge her.
So Jamie, this movie that spans like decades plus of these people's lives and has all of these intercut footage, like, I understand how that is a time machine. How is this wine a time machine? How, because you said this is entry level. This is not even meant for aging. How is it a time machine?
Right.
Jamie's got a big smirk on his face. We can get ready for some bullshit.
I like it.
Listening
I like
audience.
It a lot.
This is going to be some nonsense coming up.
In wine, we talk about wine being a time machine a lot, and specifically the way it's referenced by probably 98% of the time is when you're talking about wine that's been in a bottle for a long time.
Aged wine.
Correct.
Right.
I once drank a bottle of 1988 Zinfandel from Napa Valley, and we all in the room, you know, smelling our own farts, were like, this is a time machine of an era gone by.
Mm.
Truly, that was one of the best wine experiences I've ever had. Old Zinfandel is fucking crazy good from a great producer, but that's not what I'm talking about here. This is the 2018 vintage.
Right. This has not had any chance to age.
So,
well, I guess it's had 2.5 years to age.
But. Right. But that's like, this is current release. I think it could do with up to 5 years, but after that, you're dealing with diminishing returns. No, what I'm talking about is what I hinted at earlier, which is old vines.
Yes.
Old vines are super cool. I find them to be fascinating.
Why? Because they're old?
Partly just because they're old, but there are shifts in both winemaking and in vineyard management and in the technology that is in the vineyards and in the philosophy around putting a plant in the ground that are different from era to era.
Okay.
The big one that is easiest to think about is mechanization. In post-war America and then the world over, you have a transition to tractors in the field and machine harvesting and machine plowing and like just all of the assistance from machines in vineyards. There was a time when that was not a thing that could possibly happen. The way you make vineyards friendly to these machines is you plant in specific vine spacing from one row to the next, and then you train the vines in different ways. You're blinking at me about the use of the word training. Just, vines.
Okay. All right. So you train them, you condition them.
Either your father-in-law or your wife, or possibly you grow tomatoes. Yes.
Right. My father-in-law grows tomatoes. Yeah.
And he has, I'm presuming, cages around the tomato plants.
He does.
And the tomato vine grows up the cage.
It grows up the cage.
So the training is when your father-in-law takes a growing shoot of the vine and like passes it through the cage so that the vine now will grow along that cage. That's okay. Like the basic of like, you can just move the plant in that direction and it'll grow continue that way. In that direction.
Will it grow that way next season?
No.
That doesn't make sense.
And tomato vines are different than grapevines because grapevines can get old and have substantial hard wood to them that is more permanent.
Right. Those tomatoes we replant every year.
Right.
Because they're annuals and not perennials.
Which is what grapes are.
It does seem like both of those words mean the same thing.
It does.
I don't care for that.
Either do I.
It's not wine's fault. It's agriculture's fault. And it's stupid.
Noted. Scotty's gripe with agriculture.
It's dumb. And I wish that words could be used in ways that made sense to me and not in ways where it's a free-for-all and anything can mean whatever we want it to.
Duly noted. The next time I have a meeting with agriculture, I'll bring that up.
You take it up with big agriculture, Jamie.
I will. So for vines, what this means, the way that these old vineyards are trained is called either bush training or head training. They are made to grow in such a way where they support themselves.
Okay.
The old wood grows up and then all of the grapes and the seasonal part, the shoots that it puts out and the leaves grow on top of that hardwood. In a more mechanized vineyard, you would train that hardwood onto a trellis, which would go out in two different directions, giving you sort of like a two-dimensional area where the grapes grow. And you would specifically have your fruiting zone at a level where a machine could then like thwack the grapes off of the vine.
I think I just blacked out while you were just explaining all of that.
Okay. I'm just going to move on.
Okay, that's fine.
And you'll understand that.
I'll understand it later.
Mechanization changes how the vines look specific, like how they exist in the field.
How they're planted is different now.
Yeah.
And these vines are from before mechanization.
Right. So the oldest of them come from, and I mentioned the Bedrock Vineyard and the Evangelo Vineyard. Bedrock being in Sonoma, Evangelo being in Contra Costa, both of them being planted in the 1800s. Bedrock in 1888, Evangelo in 1890. They were both planted shortly after phylloxera, the vine louse that devastated vines the world over.
The world over.
The world over.
That's on your bingo cards, by the way, everybody at home. If you're making your own, gonna need a bigger bottle of bingo cards.
Phylloxera. We mention it.
Phylloxera comes up literally every episode.
It was an important shift. And it also means that the number of vines that exist from prior to phylloxera are shrinkingly few. The oldest vines in the world, or most of the oldest vines in the world, still have been planted post-phylloxera.
Really?
Yes.
So there's almost nothing pre-phylloxera.
Correct.
It's all gone.
Almost nothing. There are some exceptions.
Do they taste good?
The pre-phylloxera vines?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are they super expensive?
Yep.
Because of the rarity of the vine?
Yep. The older a vine gets, the less fruit it produces. So you're talking about head-trained vines in these vineyards that are often interplanted with other varieties. I mentioned the mixed blacks vineyards. So you'd have Zinfandel be like the backbone of the vineyard. But in order to... You know, you're talking about a time that didn't have laboratory analysis, that didn't have the ability to get a picking crew on a moment's notice out to the vineyard. So in order to build in some insurance that maybe that you would have some concentration, maturity, acidity, potential alcohol, like everything that you need, you would plant other varieties that ripen in a different way from your main variety. Does that make sense?
I believe I understand you.
Cool.
Yes.
So these vineyards produce a totally different product. You're talking about very concentrated fruit because of the lower amount of fruit on each vine, which gives you a big impact of flavor. So this ties in with technique a little bit because the methods used to farm these vineyards are totally different because you can't drive tractors down a lot of them. The head-trained vines are either too tall or too short. You'll damage them with a tractor in some way. And also they have to be hand-harvested. mechanized harvesters can't handle a bush-trained vine.
What's a mechanized wine or grape harvester look like?
It looks like a tractor on stilts.
A tractor on stilts. So okay,
you would drive it over a vine row.
Over the vine.
Yeah. And inside there are like thwackers. They're like thwackers. Paddles that knock the grapes off of the vine.
And then they just fall down and then somebody comes and collects it?
They fall into a collection tub, receptacle, whatever.
Huh.
We're talking about fruit that is from old vines that is farmed in a different way. The flavor of this wine, the concentration of it, the acidity, the tannin, all of the intensity of it wouldn't be possible with young vines. It would be entirely different.
It would be different less because of the vine and the product than it is because of the requirements of harvesting because of how the old vines are planted.
It's all of it. It's the age of the vine producing more concentrated fruit, but then also that you're going in and hand harvesting, which means you're not destroying the fruit, not destroying, but in that like paddle thwacking
thing. I imagine like, there's a little bit of loss, right? There's some shortage.
There's loss, and then you expose juice to oxygen as opposed to the berries remaining intact.
Right. It seems like a terrible way. I feel like thwacking your agricultural product off the vine is not... That just sounds like bruised fruit guaranteed.
It's not great, but it's just necessary in a lot of places.
For like, just like speed and efficiency and labor
economically,
cost.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just what has to happen.
Mm. Art versus commerce.
Yep. It sucks.
Yeah.
So it's a time machine in the farming techniques. It's a time machine in the literal age of the vines. And that translates to a different character in the wine. How is this movie? I mean, you hinted at it. How is this movie a time machine?
So when we first get our first glimpse of Bing's archival footage of like skate videos that he'd been shooting for fucking ever, like it's very tricky and very sly the way that he essentially flashes back to an earlier, seemingly brighter and happier time when we see all of his joy skating and all of Zach's joy skating and Kier. And it's fun and it's familiar and there's laughter. We open with the three of them skating together. And that amazing skating sequence of just being following them. He is on a skateboard for all of that.
Right.
He'd been shooting skate videos like with fisheye lenses on like little, you know, mini DV cameras since he was 14. So he had a lot of experience filming. We go from that into this first montage and like there's a melancholy like quality to that opening, the first big skate sequence.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. The music is so fucking lyrical and those like trickling reverby pianos. And then we jump to the archival footage and its childhood and its youth and its adolescence and its rebellion. And it just sets you up for something else that like when we see the same footage of them skating later on in the big climactic montage, all of those images mean so much more now that we know what their childhood is about.
Yeah, they mean something totally different.
Yeah.
You know, it's not childhood joy. It's
escapism.
It's escape from trauma.
Yeah.
Which like is also their childhood joy. Like they're not two separate things,
yeah.
But they're both. It's both at the same time.
Yeah. And we're shown them in different ways and they mean different things to the audience in the two different points in the movie.
It plays with time in a really, really evocative and awesome way.
Yeah. Bing, Kier, and Zach. How far back do you think those guys go?
Well, they mention in the movie that Bing and Kier met when Kier was 11. And in the movie, we're led to believe that he gets to 19, 20.
I think Kier is like 20 by the time the movie's over. Yeah.
And then Bing and Zach seem like they go farther back.
So that is an illusion that was accidentally created. You think that Zach and Kier are best buds with Bing because he's got so much footage of them together as kids. But it's actually just because they were all part of the same kind of insular skate community in Rockford. Bing and Zach were not really friends prior to this project. And Bing did not recall meeting Kier until after they started making the movie. And it was only when he started looking at his archival footage that he spotted Kier. You know, the part where we're talking about Kier's anger and when he loses his shit over a fight with some other kid at the playground. Yep. And he
breaks this or tries to for a while.
Yeah.
Failing. You're made to watch him fail
just
a ton of times
while
to break the skateboard.
Yeah. While in voiceover, he's describing to you his anger.
Oh, that was also a hell of a thing to watch.
Yeah. So that was the first and only time that Bing met Kier before the project started. And it was only when he dug into his archival footage and he was like, oh yeah, I'm looking, he was just looking for stuff with him or Zach on camera. And he's like, oh yeah, and here's that part, that one time where that one kid like lost his shit and broke his skateboard. And then watching the footage, he's like, oh my God, is that Kier? Like he'd already been shooting with him for like a year or 2 years at that point. But so it's all of that footage that there's a dynamic to the three of them that you get.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very easy to just assume that they are three best buds.
Yep.
Because of the intimacy and the like the very easy casual camaraderie that comes across on screen. And Bing was surprised in interviews and people were like, oh, well, what was it like to put like your best friends up on screen and to deal with their personal stuff? He's like, oh, we really just had more of like a professional relationship. We weren't really friends at all. But you get that sense because of all the archival footage. And then it leads you to these magical moments, like the big montage at the end of the movie where we get a Bing montage of him skate footage from when he's a teenager, kind of montaging through a lot of the major like skate scenes or just scenes in the movie that we've seen. And then we get the same thing for Kier and the same thing for Zach.
Right.
That's your like thunderstruck time machine moment at the end where it was something that like film and montage or collage editing that you can only achieve it that way to just in the span of 15 seconds to get this glimpse, this tableau of somebody's life. I find it so powerful and it is crazy to me that he went through most of the project until just a few months before its world premiere at Sundance without including any archival footage. Because I think the movie would be great without the archival footage, but the archival stuff is what makes it magical.
Artificial or not, that feeling that they're friends makes the whole thing feel cohesive.
Yeah. The movie is about trauma and specifically generational trauma. And so to have this archival element where we can actually see them as children, we can see them. Instead, it would just be like Kier and Bing sitting on a porch with the camera pointed at Kier. And when Bing is asking him about like, you know, did your father used to abuse you? And what was it like? And how would you deal with your anger? And instead of that, we have that played over Kier losing his temper in footage. It enhances the movie and it enhances the depiction of the themes that he's trying to talk about by being able to express time that way. Like time is a major dimension in this movie and beyond just the idea of linear time of like the 90 minutes it takes me to get from start to finish of the film. There's this whole impression of time that's created by the inclusion of that footage and the way it's all perfectly edited together. The way it all just plays out and just reveals past and present and suggestions of future to you, like alternating at any given moment. Can we just talk about Kier very briefly?
Yeah, let's talk about Kier.
Just briefly.
What do you have to say about Kier?
I just love him immediately.
Yeah.
The first time he shows up on screen.
Lovable person.
He has crazy screen presence and he's
charisma.
And he's totally open too. He's like, Zach is much more opaque.
Yeah.
And Zach will tell you what he's thinking, but you can tell that he's actually thinking something else.
And Zach's a performer.
He's a performer, but he's also, there's a lot of denial. Like he won't admit to himself certain things that he's done or certain behaviors or patterns that he's fallen into. Whereas Kier seems much more self-aware of his own behavior. And he just also has like a $1 million smile. Like there's so much fucking joy. When Bing Lu talked with IndieWire's Filmmaker Toolkit podcast about the movie, he was saying that like one of the really wild experiences was watching the movie with Kier, like showing him the cut for the first time before Sundance, and that Kier was like a mirror to himself on screen. So whenever Kier on screen was laughing, Kier in the room was laughing. When Kier on screen was crying, Kier on screen was like violently sobbing.
That's intense.
And but for him to experience that with the person who filmed it all must have been just such a fucking trip.
Yeah. He's also a great foil for the other two. Zach is sort of the polar opposite where he's not self-aware and he's always performing in one way or another.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand as much about himself or his own surroundings.
At least that's how he's portrayed on screen.
That's the character of Zach. And then the character of Bing is more analytical. And if there's like a portrait of like the differentiated response, the like less emotional, still like very aware, but removed from the situation, even though he's in the fucking situation.
Even though he's straight up in it.
That's his way of dealing with it,
yeah.
Is analyzing it, which is, I'm guessing, why he picked up a camera in the first place. Mouth-filling. A mouthful.
All right.
Mouth.
Mouth-filling. But this is not mouth-feel. We're not talking about the texture. We're talking about how it fills your mouth.
Correct.
Which is separate from mouthfeel.
Yes. Well, Jamie, I mean, it's not separate from. It is a part of mouthfeel.
A part of mouthfeel. Please somehow explain to me how this wine is mouthfilling, and is it more or less mouthfilling than other mouthfilling wines?
I'd say that it's, as it compares to other wines that might be described as mouthfilling, this one might be right down the middle.
But so mouthfilling has nothing to do with the volume of wine that I pour into my mouth.
No, but
because
like,
they can't control.
Think about
for
the
that.
Experience of drinking this wine. It is full bodied and high alcohol. It's the you're out of wine.
I'm out of wine.
Do you want more?
I don't want to think about the experience. I want to have the. Oh, you'd have to open a bottle
no,
for that.
It's been Coravind. I drank from it, so oh, now I'm right. just going to pop the cork.
It's been what?
Coravind.
While you're opening this bottle noisily, what does that mean?
So a Coravind is a device that puts a needle through the cork of the bottle.
And sucks out all the oxygen.
No, it injects argon gas.
Which displaces all the oxygen.
Which displaces wine and protects the remaining wine from oxygen.
I don't understand.
I know.
How does it displace wine? If the cork is already in the bottle, how is it going to displace the wine?
You first inject the argon, which then, because of pressure in the bottle, pushes wine out.
Where does the wine go?
Into a glass.
Okay, so this is not a process that is happening while the cork is in the bottle.
This is a process. I literally just said you put the needle through the cork.
All right, I want to be very clear here. We're having a failure to communicate, but the failure is yours.
I disagree. The failure is entirely yours.
So the cork is in the bottle.
Just sit there and listen to me. I'm gonna paint you the picture.
I mean, we did this once already and it didn't work, but okay, let's try again.
Okay, cork is in the bottle.
Right.
You have a device which you push a needle through the cork that then injects argon gas into the bottle, which because of pressure then pushes wine out of the bottle into a glass. So you have a sealed bottle still where you have extracted wine and replaced the volume of that wine in the bottle with argon gas.
How does the wine get out of the bottle during the act of displacement?
The same needle that the argon goes through.
There we go. All right, great. Now yes. I understand. Cool. So the argon goes
wine
in,
comes out.
The wine That's comes correct. Back out. And so you're drinking delicious, delicious, argonized wine.
Argon is a neutral, it's one of the noble gases. It does not react with really anything at all. And the idea is that nothing happens to the wine and you now have a preserved bottle that you can taste from many, many days later, weeks, months, even. I'm going to step away for a second so that I can pour you
several minutes
wine.
Later. I still don't have any wine in my glass. Jamie's like, so think about the experience of drinking this wine. And then I'm trying to think about it. And meanwhile, I'm hearing fucking 10 minutes about
this
device that Jamie has that he doesn't understand how it works and cannot explain how it works. It smells
different. This fucking guy is breaking my balls.
I think it's because of your organizer. It smells different. It smells like warm farts.
That's an interesting tasting.
Warm, neutral farts.
You're just a weird, strange person who likes to antagonize me.
That is true.
All right. So now that there's wine in your glass and you've tasted it.
Mouth filling.
And I've described body on this podcast before as the difference between skim milk and whole milk.
It's your viscosity.
Right. This is viscous. This is big.
And we describe that as filling my mouth.
Does it not give you the impression that like it takes up more space, like coats every area of your mouth?
So that because all of my mouth feels like it's coated, I have the sense that there is a greater volume of wine in my mouth than there actually is?
Correct.
I don't think so.
Like if I were to pour you the next wine, the Riesling, into a separate glass, it would be a totally different impression. It wouldn't.
But I don't know that I would feel like my mouth is more full than I do with this one.
Huh. When you take a bite of a ribeye steak.
Right.
That's a different impression in your mouth than exactly the same amount of a chicken breast.
Sure. But
you're being too literal. Like it gives you a visceral.
Jamie,
like,
I'm talking about the words that you use to describe the wine. I'm allowed to be literal when
you a pain in the ass.
I'm just saying it doesn't feel any more or any less mouth filling. Like I understand what you're going for. I don't
understand how you're not. I like fundamentally it does to me feel like there's more. Like I know that it's the same amount of wine per sip, but when it's a fuller bodied wine. Or when it's a more fatty product, it gives me the impression that there is more weight, that there's more intensity, that there is more in my mouth.
I don't think I have that experience.
Interesting.
I think maybe my mouth mechanism is a more precise one than yours.
I'm gonna slap
because you. It is not able to be deceived by body and viscosity. And so I'm able to tell, despite the body, what the actual volume of food or drink matter is in my mouth. I see what you're going for. I simply do not have the same experience. It does have body, though.
It does. It's got body. It announces its presence. It's loud.
It's not a quiet wine.
No.
It's punchy.
And volume is another good analogy that we could use here. The sound of a speaker on low volume can be projected to a particular, you know, distance, let's say. But if you turn up the volume in a closed environment, that fills the room more, or it gives you that impression. I'm moving on from this, from arguing this point.
Well, I just don't think you understand like how audio.
I don't understand works. How audio works.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that this like magically expands in your mouth, but it gives you the impression that your whole mouth is filled. I don't fucking know. I'm so annoyed by you right now. I can't even describe.
I'm by my own nature, I am a semantic pain in the ass, and I will interrogate every single word choice you make for the rest of your life.
Really? I hadn't noticed in our 25 years of friendship.
At least so long as there is a microphone recording.
One of the things that I have said a number of times about Zinfandel specifically, but also about some other wines, is that, are you aware of this thing where a lot of professional and or high school football players are put through ballet training to make them like better at footwork?
I am not, but it makes sense.
Right? This to me is an NFL player performing ballet, this wine. It's big and powerful, but still really precise and light on its feet. The zippy acidity, as I described before, cleanses your palate right after that like big mouth-filling punch you get in the beginning. Leaves you sort of wanting more and giving you that pleasant impression as opposed to it just laying on your mouth the way some of the more amped up, gloppy versions of Zinfandel that have some sugar can do. It also has this broadness of fruit character to it. Everything from really tart pomegranate, underripe wild strawberry, aronia berry, also called chokeberry, all the way to sweet stewed prunes, crushed blackberries, almost like a cherry pie situation, and kind of everything in between. This is another one of those things that I just love about Zinfandel, is it's kind of all things. You know, people who are looking for tart fruit can find it here. People who are looking for something more jammy and concentrated can also find it here.
And that's mouth-filling.
Yeah. This is getting even more abstract, which is like filling the spectrum of flavor.
Because there's so many flavors. You consider that mouth-filling. All right.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. I mean, obviously, for me, I had a lot of notes about the flavor of this wine.
Right.
And maybe it's just because there were so many more checkboxes for it to tick off.
And part of that is due to specifically Zinfandel's behavior in the vineyard. The grape is prone to what's called mille rondage, which is differentiated ripeness on the cluster. So in one grape cluster, you can have an overripe raisinated berry with plenty of perfectly ripe berries with also some green underripe berries. And that gives you a broad spectrum of flavor and like preservation of acidity from the underripe berries, and then the like stewed fruit and high sugar and thus high alcohol percentage of the raisinated berries.
Are grapes berries?
I mean, scientifically, I think so, yeah. I mean, they are referred to as berries by winemakers and viticulturalists.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's kind of mind-bending. Grapes are berries. This is the first time you've said that on this show.
Bananas are berries, too.
No, that's not acceptable.
It's true.
I disagree.
But
no. I'll allow a grape. It's small. It's round. You know, it grows in bunches.
You know it's not a berry? Strawberries are not berries.
Because their seeds are on the outside.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Banana seeds are on the inside.
Bananas are berries.
So anything with the seeds on the inside is a berry?
I think like a bell pepper is a berry.
Apparently also berries are cucumbers and eggplants, but not strawberries or raspberries.
That's correct.
I'm glad no words have any meaning to anyone even remotely related to your profession.
We're going to have a banana berry later.
All right. Shut up.
I said mouth-filling about this wine. What about this movie led you?
Well, if one were to be a literal pain in the ass.
Theoretically, if one were to be that way.
When I say that, what I mean is not if one were to inflict pain upon someone's ass, but if one were to be a obsessively literal semantic person who is a pain in the ass about that.
Right. The colloquial pain in the ass.
Right. A literal colloquial pain in the ass. Thank you. You would say that this is not mouth filling at all because it's a movie and it does not enter your mouth. But this movie is a mouthful in the sense that it is too complex and knotty to describe simply. I find it to be a mouthful in that way. And we were talking about how like it's a difficult movie to pitch to people. Bing has even said in interviews that like it's kind of got to be a word of mouth thing for people because people have to sit in front of it to find out what it is.
Right.
And even in the marketing and the promotion, like they did largely hold back from the child abuse stuff. It's meant to be not a reveal, but like it's something you need to get into, right? You need to see it to understand how that's going to manifest. So for me, that level of complexity really centers on the character or the subject of Zach. The way that his child abuse is now manifesting as this generational pattern where he is abusing his partner. And there is the threat that no one explicitly addresses, but it just lingers over the whole back half of the movie, which is Zach going to abuse his child?
Right.
Nobody ever says it, but it's just this horrible fucking like axe hanging over your head the whole rest of the film.
Well, because the obvious answer is yes. It
is yes, right? That is the obvious answer. That he will do the unspeakable and he will abuse his child the same way that he was abused. And I think the complexity of that, the way it's depicted, not just the complexity of Zach being a child who was abused and now coming into a relationship where now he is also passing on the abuse and the difficulty in describing generational trauma, but also in the difficulty in articulating that on screen. Bing has to navigate some pretty choppy ethical waters for a person in general, but also for a documentarian. He struggled with Nina's revelation to him that Zach was abusing her.
I mean, how could one not?
How could you not? Like you struggle with that knowledge, but then you struggle with, well, now I have this and I have it on camera. What do I do with it?
Right.
Can I include the footage? Can I follow that thread and try and ask more questions of the both of them? Am I placing her in danger? Am I placing the baby in danger by continuing to ask questions about this? He said it was a moral crisis for him as a filmmaker and as a person. He took a 48-hour domestic violence course. He sought counsel from other documentarians and mentors. A few of them explicitly told him, like, you absolutely cannot ask Zach about this. If you're going to talk about it, you need to find another way to get to it because you cannot break her confidence. And Bing felt that it was ultimately Zach who opened the door for him because Zach is the one who shows him the footage on the phone of the two of them having a fight, which is what leads Bing to ask Nina, Zach showed me this footage about this terrible verbal fight you guys were having. And she's like, oh, well, yeah, he left out the part where he beat the shit out of me 10 minutes before that. And so that was Bing's way to get into it and to come back to Rockford again and to ask Zach, like, hey, so that fight footage that you showed me, like, do you ever think about how your fighting with her is maybe the result of your parents fighting? And that was his way in. But even beyond that, like, it's just such a complex portrait of a person to put on screen. Bing said about Zach and specifically the way that Zach is portrayed in the movie. With Zach, he's so charismatic and so extroverted that he relished being on camera a little bit more. As we filmed more and more dark parts of his life, I just kept checking in with him and saying, how do you feel about everything I've captured, both on and off camera? And he was just like, what you're getting is what you're getting. When I showed him the film, he actually told me he was relieved because he thought he was going to be portrayed the worst. That level of pressure of how you depict that character and that relationship.
Yeah.
How do you unpack all of that in a 90-minute movie where you also have two other subjects that you need to follow?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that he didn't unpack all of it. There's a lot that's put on screen and there's a lot that's left for us to think about and sit with because there is no conclusion there. You could, like, the conclusion would be, I don't know, him pushing Zach into some sort of a domestic violence course, but the documentarian can't do that. And then it becomes a whole other thing. Yeah. It's a hard one.
Yeah.
While you were just talking, I thought about the, and I hadn't thought about this, the danger that Zach is going to abuse his child.
Yeah.
One of the things you get early on from Zach is Bing asks him whether he was abused. And it's a really casual answer that he gives.
Yeah. It was so commonplace in his life that for Zach, it's just like, well, everybody gets beat.
Right.
Everybody gets abused.
That's your devastating answer to that question.
Yeah. And we never get any sense of his like family outside of his partner and the baby. Like with Kier, we see his mom. We get a sense of what's going on with his brother and what's going on with like his mom's new boyfriend who pops up for one scene. And we hear a lot about Kier's dad. And with Zach, it's just that is something that is either not available to Bing during the making of the movie, but it's certainly not available to the audience. It's just that one kind of dashed off revelation from Zach. That's kind of all we have to go on there.
To take it back a little bit to the time machine part, Bing and Kier are the past. Their threads are the threads of the past. And
right.
Zach and Nina, that's the thread of the future.
Right.
And that's a really bleak portrait on all counts, because it's, you know, the trauma leads to trauma leads to trauma leads to trauma.
Yeah.
And breaking the cycle is impossible, question mark.
Or at the very least, extremely difficult.
I haven't attempted to recommend this movie to anyone yet, but I don't know what my pitch would be. And I'm sure that I would trip over myself a bunch.
Yeah.
And my mouth would be full of words. Figuratively, not literally, because words don't take up space.
No. It's a difficult one to recommend to people, as apparently are many of the movies that I have recommended to people as a part of this podcast.
Literally every time someone's like, is that a good movie? I will always say yes, except for Tenet, which sucks.
Tenet's pretty good, everybody. Tenet's
a piece of shit.
Tenet's real cool.
Crappy, bullshit movie without emotions. But it's hard to recommend a lot of these movies because it's like, yes, it's a great movie. You have to be emotionally in a place where you can handle this.
For me, the perfect briefest distillation of what I thought of when you said mouthful is that intercut sequence between Bing and his mom concluding their interview and then Zach and Bing when Bing is at the sunset by the water. Yep. and Zach admits to abusing her, and then really more emotionally than he ever has before, like admits to all the ways that his life is fucked up and that how he's responsible, but he can't take responsibility. And then also intercutting with Kier and Bing at the cemetery looking for Kier's dad's gravestone.
That was so hard.
This is one of the things that Josh Altman, the editor, put together with Bing. That was one of his major contributions. But to put those three things in conversation with each other, it is so thoughtful about how those ideas complement each other and talk to each other. Bing and his mom are discussing an abusive father. Zach is confessing to being an abusive partner and possibly father. And then Kier is in tears tracking down the gravestone of the father that abused him. Like, you put all of those three things together and it's like maybe 2.5 minutes of screen time. That is a mouthful. Like, you could write a book unpacking just that couple of minutes and what it does. It's the movie's entire conversation basically in one 2-minute montage sequence. And it's extraordinary.
It's a lot. It's a lot of conversation.
It is.
It's a lot to get out. It's a lot to prepare someone for when you're trying to tell them about this movie.
It's a mouthful. Speaking of things that are difficult to summarize and describe with words easily.
Yes.
How in the Christ is this wine urban? They're not growing on the like rooftop gardens of... No.
So very, very literally.
Yes.
The winery is in a city.
Oh, all right. How does that translate to the taste of the wine?
So that...
It does not at all.
No, I'm going to throw you out of my house.
But we have another episode to record after this.
Get you a pain in the ass. God damn it. This is going to be a good rest of the day.
Yes, it is.
Literally, it's in a city. Yes, it affects the taste. It absolutely does. And we've already touched on perspective.
Okay.
In the movie. What I wanted to bring up here as this wine relates to the movie is perspective.
Okay.
The movie begins from Bing's perspective specifically. He's holding the camera. His voice is disembodied from behind the camera. And then he moves.
Eventually in front of the camera.
In front of the camera. And there's a perspective shift. Here, I don't think that it's a difficult argument to make that a person living in a city has a different perspective on the world than someone living in a rural farming area.
I'm with you so far.
There are ideas floating around. There are more people around. It's a whole different way of, there are different ideas in the air there are more ideas in the air is what I'm getting at.
In a city
than in a rural area. There are a number of sort of urban wine centers that have sprung up, particularly on the East Coast of the U.S. Notably in Santa Barbara, there's a place called the Lompoc Wine Ghetto, colloquially referred to as such, where there are a ton of different winemakers in an industrial park, essentially, in a more urban area. And they all work very, very close together, and they source their grapes from the surrounding Santa Barbara area. They are able to trade ideas, but also equipment and manpower in order to make something without as much capital investment as it would be to buy a winery and a vineyard out in the farmland.
Okay. I track so far.
With me so far. There's another one called Tin City in Paso Robles. Same kind of deal. It's sort of an industrial park kind of area, and people can share a press with your neighbor or a pump or whatever the case may be, whatever piece of equipment. But also you're constantly in conversation with everyone, like, hey, how's your pick going? You know, you've booked such and such crew to pick such and such vineyard at such and such time.
They're sharing resources, but it's also like it's an intellectual marketplace, right? Like all these different vineyards or winemakers are coming together and they're cross-pollinating ideas and processes.
Correct. And they're also able to cross-pollinate their ideas with local restaurants and sommeliers and sort of have an idea of what's going on farther afield in the world of wine. That's what I mean by urban. The marketplace of ideas that a city offers as compared to the rural countryside.
That makes sense to me. But this is increasingly common, the urban wine centers?
Yeah, and Dash was not the first, but in the first wave of like, oh, we can open up a winery in an industrial park and have like an iron gate, you know, like almost a storage container kind of situation for our winery. And that's a lot less expensive than doing it out in the country, but also it puts us in conversation with everybody else. And I, as a person who has lived in a city for a long time. An urbanite myself. I very much value that about cities. I very much value being close to so many different people with different viewpoints where I can have conversations that lead me to different ideas.
Mm. I miss conversations. Conversations are nice.
We're having one right now.
Yeah, this is okay. But like, you know,
this is okay.
This
thanks,
is fine.
Buddy.
This is okay. Well, what do you,
I mean, obviously this movie takes place.
It's in Rockford. Rockford is like a medium sized city. For me, the reason the movie is urban to talk about like extreme cliches, like you were talking earlier about how like this wine is a time machine. Well, we all sniff our own farts about aged bottles, right?
Right.
A big cliche in talking about movies is that, oh, well, the city is really like the fourth character in the movie. Like fucking yes. Shoot me in the head for every time in a review I have to read that like New York really is a character in this film. That said, Rockford is kind of a character in the movie. Not through any like bullshitty kind of way. It's just, it's depicted so much. The skating footage in particular, that beautiful, like exquisite skating footage that Bing shoots. And I don't mean the archival stuff. I mean like all the present day, the seemingly present day stuff. You see so much of the city. You see the streets, you see the industrial parks, you see parking lots and residential areas and downtown. You see them crossing traffic. You feel like you've been in that place. And then we see even more. We see their homes. We see their families. We see local businesses. Like you genuinely get a sense of this community.
I was going to say that obviously you can't say that a city necessarily has a character arc, but I think it's given one
in this
movie?
Interesting. What do you mean?
Well, in the archival footage in the beginning, you see this skate park that looks really clean, well-established, beautiful, and you're led to believe, or at least, you know, I am not used to seeing skate parks like that in economically depressed areas.
Mm, interesting.
And so in the beginning, I'm thinking of Rockford as a more thriving area, simply because of that, just because this skate park looks beautiful. And then you zoom out and everything around it is kind of in disrepair. And the local businesses are that way. And their homes are kind of in dire straits.
Yeah.
And so you're given this first impression that is, I guess, subjective to their youth because they're so excited to be at the skate park. And then you're given the real picture.
Right.
In that opening sequence that's very stabilized and beautiful and they're skating through the streets, I was like, oh, they obviously like closed the streets to shoot this sequence.
Right. Definitely how things work for documentaries. you close off streets all the time.
Right, but it felt that way because there's fucking nothing.
There's nothing.
No cars and they're unconcerned. They're not even looking either way to see if something.
They cross one street that has like traffic stopped at it and otherwise there are no cars on the road in that whole sequence.
And not even one pedestrian.
Again, that could just be the illusion of like what's presented to us, but it very firmly gives you a sense of this particular place and yeah, just what it's like to live there. Oh, and then the other thing that we get is there, Bing goes out of his way in the edit. There are, I think, two or three montages where there's audio of news broadcasts is laid over our footage of our two or three subjects describing socioeconomic stats about Rockford, right, talking about unemployment and other like indicators of the health of the city. So like he does go out of his way to contextualize the world that he and Zach and Kier grew up in. It's a pretty important part of the big picture of this movie.
So this movie has terroir.
Well, kind of, because terroir is the expression of place, right?
Yep.
I don't think the movie is trying to show you how Bing is a product of Rockford, but I do think he is trying to give you a sense of where Rockford is, or of what Rockford is.
I also think that this is more in line with the way that I would like to see the word terroir used.
In reference to movies and not wine.
Well, also in wine.
Yeah. I mean, you just want them to banish the word terroir from discussion of wine.
No, I think that there's some use to it, and there is some expression of the place, but this is an expression of Rockford through specifically the lens of these three guys.
Right.
In the same way that Dash Zinfandel is an expression of Sonoma through the eyes of Michael and Ann Dash. You cannot separate it from the people, but that doesn't stop it from being a lens to look at a place through.
So you're fine with terroir as long as it's not the only or like most important thing, the only like the most important prism that we look at wine through.
Right. I think that very much in the conversation of terroir, we don't talk about the people, or we minimize the importance of the people, or we talk about how the people are just trying to get out of the way. I've said it before, agriculture is a fundamentally unnatural thing. These vines would not grow this way, except that we put them there. And so the people are necessary to the process and are part of the terroir.
Terroir.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have to say. I just want to say terroir seductively several more times on microphone.
Well said.
Terroir.
Let's move along.
I agree. Before we decide amongst ourselves, objectively and for all time, if this is a good pairing.
Yes.
We got to get into it. We didn't do it last time. I feel bad about this. Wife Takes.
I love Wife Takes.
Wife Takes, the podcast game that's sweeping the nation of me and Jamie and this show.
It's sweeping the tens of listeners.
Tens of listeners. We recorded this for our previous episode about The Irishman, and I fucked it up. And only after recording it did I realize that I made it way too easy for Jamie by reading everything that was given to me by my dearest wife. So this time, Wife Takes is back by popular demand.
And Scotty's not going to fuck it up.
And I'm not going to fuck it up this time. So Wife Takes. In this case, it's three truths and a lie.
Three truths and a lie. She's fucking with me now.
She's going wild. So this is a game in which my darling wife, Tani, will recreate her favorite thing to fuck with Jamie over when we used to go to his fine dining restaurants, where she would tell him all of the silliest and most pretentious ways that she might describe the experience of drinking a wine, only to mock him and his, you know, delicate sommelier sensibilities. But so our first round here, I'm going to give Jamie four wife-style descriptors of this here wine, and he has to guess which one of them is complete bullshit as compared to the other three, which are just like rhetorical bullshit. So first up, which of the following did Tani not detect on the nose of this Zinfandel? A, the baked-in glaze from the top of a meatloaf. B, lightly crushed grains of paradise.
Are you a pain in the ass, Tani?
C, fresh figs. Or D, the goopy overflow from a berry pie that you can scrape off of a baking sheet with your fingernail?
I'm going to go with fresh figs.
The answer is C. She detected dried Turkish figs.
Yep.
She's going to be so mad that you got that. All right, so Jamie's got one.
It was the inclusion of the word fresh. First of all, I don't get fresh figs on this wine. I do get dried and or stewed figs.
Whereas I just get figs in general because I'm not that perceptive.
I mean, a dried fig and a fresh fig are two entirely different things.
Not to me, baby. It's just figs.
Yeah, that's why you don't understand what mouth filling is.
Hey, Jamie, I got steak sauce, okay? Back the fuck off.
I could go for a steak.
Yeah, me too. Let's get some lunch. All right, so next up, we're only doing two rounds today. Which of the following fanciful statements does not evoke 2018 Dash Cellar Zinfandel? A, the feeling of completing a task under budget and ahead of schedule. B, mammatus clouds at dawn.
God damn it.
C, Alan Rickman's voice circa 1995, specifically in his role as Colonel Brandon in Sense of Sensibility, specifically the line where he says of his time abroad that the air is full of spices. Or D, the feeling of fur between your fingers while scritching a very large and friendly dog.
It's A. A. A is bullshit.
The answer is B.
Bullshit.
B is bunk. She says, this is actually a description of the pink and voluptuous Maison Noir love drunk. Which she reminds me that was not included in our previous record or previous episode release. So anyway, Jamie is 1 for 2 on this week's game of this wife takes.
The first wife take that I have failed on.
That you got wrong.
Yeah.
And you got it real wrong too.
Does this pairing work?
I don't fucking know. I didn't have any like magic synesthetic experience, but like I drank a lot of the wine while I watched the movie. I don't know if there's crossover. This is kind of more what I was imagining for something that might in an obvious way pair with The Irishman, something that's like dark and red and tannic and complex and difficult. I think the what you described as like the broadness, right?
Yeah.
The broadness of the wine, the enormous like volume of fruit and other types of flavors. I think that works for me like intellectually with the movie. I don't think it's a bad pairing. I didn't have like the synesthetic spark though.
I think it worked for me kind of in the same way that Love Drunk worked with The Irishman, in that this is a difficult thing and this wine is like a pillow to land on. Anytime something bad happened, I took a sip and I was comforted because this wine for me is like a weighted blanket. I think we could easily have switched Love Drunk and this for The Irishman.
Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And both would have worked, and
yeah,
maybe even a little bit better. Because
Love Drunk is, there's a youthful quality to Love Drunk. It's bright and it's fun and it's sunny.
Yep, I think you're right. I think this wine would be a better pair for The Irishman. Although its high alcohol would mean that I would have been wasted by the end.
By the end. Because for me, a bottle of wine is roughly a one Irishman length experience. But for you, one Irishman length experience is it four cases? Is that how much it is?
Yeah, four cases of wine in one sitting. That's how I drink.
Hey man, you're a professional. You have a tolerance. I'm impressed. Proud is not the right word, but like you can hold your own. I
appreciate your validation. Thank you. And then Love Drunk would be better at highlighting the joy, as you say.
The joy, the laughter.
Because there is joy in Minding the Gap. There is not really in The Irishman.
All right, so Jamie, I think we agree that the pairing basically works, but that if we switch this with our previous episode, it might work even better. Both of them might work better.
Yes.
But if people like this wine, what would be the next glass?
So I would do a flight with this wine, followed by Turley Old Vines, followed by Bedrock Old Vines. I think that gives you a picture of the grape and older vineyards from the perspective of different winemakers with different backgrounds. And while the wines do present really similarly, there are some very specific differences. For instance, this is the probably easiest drinking of the three, and Turley has a bit more refinement, isn't the word, precision, I guess, precision in its presentation. That silkiness that I talk about with this wine, the acidity, everything feels fully integrated with itself. It is a complete picture that is more difficult to pull specific notes out of. And then Bedrock is a little bit more opaque. For sure, and a more ageable example of the three, it's the product of two now generations of specifically Zinfandel winemakers who come at it from like a very specifically Sonoma viewpoint.
Hmm.
So yeah, I would do a flight of three. I would do Dash Cellars next to Turley, next to Bedrock.
I will drink some of those at some point.
What's the double feature for this movie, Scotty?
I would recommend people check out a very, very good doc from 2020 called Boy State, which I think we've talked about before. I think I showed you the trailer for Boy State.
And you've recommended that I watch it, and I have considered it on a number of evenings.
You just have to sign up for that Apple TV+. It is exclusive to Apple TV Plus, which is a pain in the ass that it's exclusive. It's otherwise a great documentary. The doc is not a pain in the ass. This is a doc that follows a handful of high school aged, politically interested and ambitious young men who attend the Texas Boys State Conference, which in, I believe it's every state in the country, they have what's called a boys state. And now they have a girl state as well, where kids with an interest in political science come together. And it's basically like a big model Congress. It lasts about a week and it teaches them the inner workings of like a state capital. It focuses on a couple of young, very charismatic men who really pop over the course of the filming. It's the other end of the spectrum in terms of documentary craft and form, but they kind of arrive at a similar focus. And I think that's a terrific fucking movie and people should check it out. Boy State on the Apple TV Plus.
If I ever decide to pull the trigger on Apple TV Plus, that'll be.
It's $5 a month. Just do it for Boy State, for fucking Ted Lasso, and for All Mankind, and then just move on and cancel it.
Sure. All right. Next time on.
Next time on, because this podcast is not over. We're doing more of these for some reason. So Jamie.
Because we can't help ourselves.
In continuing, Jimby's big honking spittoon of wine dribblings of America. What is next?
That was bad.
These are better when I write them ahead of time.
Yeah. That was, I mean, spittoon, that's evocative.
Well, what do you call it when you're at a tasting and you spit into a thing?
It's a spittoon.
So it is a spittoon. Yeah. All right, great. So it was the accurate word to use.
Yeah.
So on the spittoon that is this podcast, what is the next wine that we're—
Can we rename the podcast?
Swishing and
Scott spitting? And Jamie's spittoon.
Scott and Jamie's wine and movie spittoon. So what are we drinking next time, James?
Well, we're drinking Riesling. Because I also like Riesling.
Shocking. Shocking that we're drinking Riesling next time. And then the time after that, maybe it'll be Rosé.
This is only
and then
the
after that,
third
it'll be
Riesling.
I think it's the fourth
it's
Riesling.
It's the third Riesling. So we're doing Cuca Lake Vineyards Riesling. This is their dry, once again, entry level offering. It's available at Astor Wine and Spirits for $22 plus shipping. I love this wine. They're super small, owned by a crotchety old man. I just love the whole crotchety old man archetype, but they've been around since the early 2000s. The wine is totally dry. It's sharp, and it's just beautiful. They're right at the southern end of Cuca Lake in the Finger Lakes.
And Jamie, what were the words? Give me them words.
So I have three words in one phrase. The phrase that I gave you was, when old school becomes new school.
That's not some nonsensical bullshit at all.
You're a dick.
Proceed.
And then screeching, textural, and expressive, which all are much easier to relate to flavor. I think that you probably were able to wrap your head around it.
Screeching, textural, and expressive?
Yes.
I mean, I didn't think that hard about how the flavor was any of those things, because I'm just trusting that you're
that
not,
I'll explain
you're
it.
Not, no, that you're not trying to describe flavor anymore.
I hate you.
And that you're just on your own thing. I have chosen 2019's The Lighthouse. This is a film directed by Robert Eggers, whose biggest claim to fame is The Witch. This is his second feature as a follow-up. It stars Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. It is an art house period piece, silent film, surrealist horror movie. I think it's kind of indescribable. It is amazing.
Would you say that it's a mouthful?
No, it's an eyeful and an earful. It is currently available to stream on the Amazon Prime. By the time this episode comes out, who the fuck knows if it'll still be available then, but it is terrific and I love it. It's fucking weird. Here's your content warning. It's fucking weird. It's super weird. If you can't deal with things that are weird and maybe involve sex with mythological creatures, then you should not watch this movie.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this one.
It's great. It's super good. Also, spoilers to everyone. This will be only our second recording since Swiss Army Man, in which Jamie and I will probably have to extensively discuss farts on the microphone. So if you guys thought that one was too juvenile, you can skip next time. And if you thought it wasn't juvenile enough, you just come right on back, because we're going to be talking about farts and cloacas next time.
And jacking it.
And jacking it too.
Lots of jacking it.
Well, that's the end of the podcast.
That's
right
the
there.
End of the podcast.
We're over.
All righty. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod.
Please.
If you have Any questions or any comments, please feel free to email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Please make sure you rate, review, and follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
But especially review. Reviews are helpful. They help people find the show. Leave us reviews. We have no new reviews this week. It's very upsetting.
Rate, review, and follow.
Rate, review, and follow. If you could follow and or subscribe on multiple platforms, that doesn't really help us at all. But like, I guess that's just your little symbolic way of being supportive, which we appreciate. This episode was produced and edited by me. Jamie handles all of our social media.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Please, though, remember to drink and watch responsibly. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. Tune back in for The Lighthouse and also Cuca Lake Vineyard Riesling.
Cuca Lake Vineyard Riesling.
Dry Riesling. It's dry.
It's dry.
It's like a regular Riesling, but except dry. All right, cool.
Deuces, y'all. Love ya.
We out. This is a long recording.
It doesn't feel that long.
Yes, it does.